Our next case is 10 SC 254, MT versus the People. Argument is set for 30 minutes, 15 minutes aside. Both parties ready? See, Mr. Turner's already ready. Are you ready? Thank you. Please, just minor housekeeping matter, please state your name for the record, and Mr. Turner, you'll have to keep track of your time.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. My name's Philip Turner, and I represent Petitioner MT. Thank you. MT pled guilty on a deferred judgment basis to attempted sexual assault on a child several years ago. After successful completion of the deferred judgment, he moved through counsel to have his case sealed under the sealing statute, 2472308. He appeared at the hearing. The government had filed an objection. There was brief argument. The objection was limited solely to a legal one, i.e., there was no argument about whether the balancing test, which is required under the statute, was an issue. The only issue presented to the court was the legal argument that, in the government's view, MT had suffered a, quote, conviction, close quote, as that phrase is used in subsection 3C of the sealing statute. The court took the matter under advisement and shortly thereafter issued an order holding that there was no conviction and therefore the record was sealed. The government then initiated an appeal, and the Court of Appeals heard the matter and wrote a published decision with one dissent. The Court of Appeals, the opinion to which you've granted certiorari, determined that the test to be applied was whether at one point in time there was a conviction. The majority opinion found that although there was no longer a conviction, that wasn't contested. At some point in time between the plea of guilty, which is part of the deferred judgment process, and the dismissal, which resulted from the completion of the deferred judgment, that even though the case had been dismissed with prejudice, there had been a conviction that was, to use the court's phrase, extant. Therefore, the wording in subsection 3C that talked about records pertaining to a conviction was operative, and that since at one point in time there had been a conviction, records pertaining to it could not be sealed. That's the most concise way to explain the Court of Appeals majority. The dissent said no. Our case law and the Supreme Court's case law teaches that, to the contrary, the conviction is, to use the dissenter's phrase, wiped clean. And the discussion between the majority and the dissent focused on three cases. The first is from this court. It's Haffelfinger versus District Court, and in particular, footnote 3. The majority below felt that footnote 3 was not dicta but part of the holding, and that that footnote stood for the proposition that at some point in time there had been a conviction. The dissent and the position we take here today argues to the contrary, that it was dicta, or alternatively, that whether it's the holding or dicta doesn't matter, because footnote 3 clearly teaches that there was no conviction at any time, because the conviction, to use the wording of Haffelfinger, was vitiated, or using the phrase we would prefer to use today, nullified. The conviction, the phrase used by the dissent below was that the slate was wiped clean. Two other Court of Appeals cases are also of import to the court below, pardon me. One is Valentin, in which there was a discussion of a deferred judgment operating as a conviction for purposes of impeaching a witness. And in Valentin, in contrast to the present case, the individual was presently on the deferred. He hadn't completed it yet. And the court held he could be impeached with that as if it was a firm felony conviction. The court was careful to note, though, that until the plea is withdrawn, that's the rule. And they implied that the rule would be different if the plea had been withdrawn after the successful completion of the deferred judgment. The third case, and the one that is most close to our situation, is one where a nurse was on a deferred judgment. She successfully completed it. Her name was Weber. In the Weber case, the medical board sought to discipline her because she had a felony conviction. And they were partially successful because there were other issues. But regarding the one we care about today, they were not. They were not because the Court of Appeals said there was no conviction. There may have, whether there was one or not wasn't the issue. She had successfully completed the deferred judgment, and having done so, there was, to quote that court, the plea of guilty to the deferred judgment never resulted in her conviction for a felony. None of this, yes, it was a felony for a portion of time and it's not any longer, or yes, it was a conviction for some period of time but it's been vitiated. They simply went right to the heart of the matter and said it never resulted in a conviction. They used the phrase, the slate was wiped clean. All of those cases stand for the proposition, when you take them together, that once the deferred judgment is completed, and in the spirit of the deferred judgment statutes, there is and never was a conviction.
Mr. Turner?
Your Honor.
Could I ask you to respond to what I, my interpretation, statutory interpretation? If you look at 2472.308, subsection C, it says, this section shall not apply to a conviction of an offense for which there is a factual basis for blah, 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 a bunch of crimes, of which your client admitted factually committing as part of the deferred judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And so I have a little trouble with not relating conviction to the first part of 1622.102, I think it's subsection 2, but I may have the subsection wrong, which includes, on that statute, includes the deferred judgments, and to the concept of something that's factually similar. I certainly understand the philosophy that deferred judgments pose and so forth, but I think we're sort of bound to the statutory construction. And I guess I'd like you to answer that.
Sure. That's the statute has a couple cross-references. The phrase in 3C, in the sealing statute, cross-references a list of crimes which are subsumed in 3C's restriction. And that cross-reference comes out of the registration statute.
Right.
The cross-reference is specifically referred to for, I think it's crimes of unlawful sexual behavior or some phrase like that.
Right.
That is not the subsection in the sealing statute that defines conviction. And there is no cross-reference in the sealing statute between the two of them.
No, but there is in the registration statute.
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that. The cross-reference comes from the sealing statute to the definition of unlawful sexual behavior, but goes no further to adopt the definition of conviction from the registration statute. And when you look at the legislative history, that's no accident.
I understand your legislative history. It says 1622.102, subsection 9.
Yes, that's the list of crimes which are, quote, unlawful sexual behavior.
Right, but that's not the registration statute.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
So why doesn't that incorporate the whole registration statute?
Because it doesn't say it does. And the preamble to the section that you're referring to in the registration statute says that this list of offenses is for purposes of this section, or pardon me, of this chapter, whatever the magic word is. In other words, the registration statute. In Dubois versus Abramson, the Court of Appeals pointed that out. Those definitions apply for the registration statute. So absent a specific cross-reference, which is absent, there's no reason to go further and adopt the definition of conviction from the registration statute. And as I said, it would be contrary to the legislative intent, which we've laid out, I think, somewhat carefully, including a direct quote from one of the people involved, who deliberately tried to and successfully exempted deferred judgments from the restriction on sealing. back in 1996. I think the legislative history is well set forth in the briefs, and I won't go into that further unless the court wishes. All of this is against a constitutional backdrop over which the parties have argued somewhat in the pleadings. This court long ago recognized a right to privacy in records when there's been an acquittal. They have not, you have not, and nor has the U.S. Supreme Court recognized a right of privacy in records where there's a conviction. But it's important to understand that the right of privacy is out there, and this is a case where the gentleman was found his case dismissed. So whether he has a constitutional right to privacy in his records remains an open question. Against that backdrop, we think it's important to understand that the court shouldn't cut off his ability to seal his record without clear legislative directive to do so. And we think it's actually just the opposite.
Counsel, can I climb over on this end?
Yes, I would like to reserve a little bit of rebuttal, but please.
If I might just follow up on that point. You seem to be contending that because there's not a specific cross-reference in the record sealing statute to the definition of conviction under the registration statute, we shouldn't import that into the record sealing statute, correct?
Yes.
If, in fact, the record sealing statute did explicitly cross-reference the definition of conviction, would you concede that your client's records could not be sealed, or how does your void ab initio argument play if, in fact, there had been a specific cross-reference? Would your concept of this deferred judgment as being void ab initio then trump that statutory language?
Well, I'm not arguing, and I don't think I could, that if the legislature passed a clear statute that said my client couldn't seal because of the offense of which he pled guilty, the legislature didn't have the authority to do that. So whether they worded it one way or another is not really the issue. We concede that they have the legislative authority to do it. They simply haven't done that here.
Okay.
That's correct. Finally, and I would like to save just a couple of minutes for rebuttal, I've given you dozens of statutes where the General Assembly has been careful to put the word conviction and deferred judgment juxtaposed in such a way that you can see they view them as different things. And the interpretation of the Court of Appeals flies in the face of all those, and it flies in the face of the rule, in fact, that this court has promulgated, that a lawyer who is prosecuted and receives a deferred judgment has to report his misconduct.
Well, you're concerned about chipping away at the whole public policy of having deferred judgments in the first place, right?
Well, we are that as well, but I think you can't read just a couple of statutes in a vacuum. You have to look at the whole legislative map, and when you do that, it takes you to the conclusion that the General Assembly, if they wanted to include deferred judgments here, should have simply said so. And the fact that they didn't say so on this legislative history with Representative DeGette's comments means to you that they never intended to bar my client from applying for sealing. And with that, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes.
You may.
My name is Michael Milne from the Senior Deputy District Attorney with the 17th Judicial District on behalf of the respondent in this case. The issue, I think, in this, I think as the court touched upon, was the statutory interpretation. And obviously we're talking about a de novo review by this court of the language in the statute that does indicate in very broad terms that the section shall not apply to records pertaining to a conviction of an offense for which the factual basis involved in unlawful sexual behavior as defined in 1622.102.9. I think one aspect of that statute, looking back at the legislation in which these particular provisions were modified in 2002, is that both 2472.308.3c and the which refers to the 1622.102.9 came out of Senate Bill 02-010 in Chapter 297, involved a relocation, reenactment of the Colorado Sex Offender Registration Act, but at the same time it addressed the change or the language changing in the ceiling, which referenced the that same statute, the Sex Offender Registration Act. As the court can see from the statute 1622-102, that's a definitional section. Paragraph 9 lists a whole bunch of particular offenses which constitute unlawful sexual behavior. The two statutes are linked in that manner. 2472-308-3C, records pertaining to a conviction, factual basis, unlawful sexual behavior as defined in that statute. It's our contention, and I know that this isn't the logic that the Court of Appeals relied on in reversing the sealing order, but conviction as contained in that statute is part and parcel of a statutory scheme, and that therefore that paragraph 9, when you talk about this variety of crimes that are also found in referenced in 2472-308-3C, we're talking about convictions in terms of also including deferred judgments. The statutes are part of a single scheme, and they deal with the same subject matter. They should be construed together.
Well, the prosecution agreed to this deferred judgment.
That is correct, Your Honor. The prosecution did go along with the deferred judgment.
Yeah, there was no discussion on the record about the implication of not being able to seal. I mean, isn't some of the incentive of this deferred judgment in this kind of context to allow an individual who qualifies for this kind of consideration to not have that publicly available?
It may be in the mind of the defense counsel, but it certainly wasn't part of the, my understanding, part of the plea bargain that led to the deferred judgment in this particular case.
We always get novel cases, it seems, on issues that you think would have long been decided. I mean, has it always been the prosecution's assertion that this deferred judgment statute in this circumstance does not involve sealing or any opportunity to request sealing? And I think that's your position.
That's our position, Your Honor, and I think there's no reason for this particular statute or exception to exist except for that, because if anyone completes, under counsel's analysis, if anybody completes a deferred judgment and the case gets dismissed, then automatically they're entitled, or at least to petition for sealing under the same standard as anyone else for a dismissal, although they are in a different. There is a huge difference in this, and in that a person who has been acquitted or when a cases or charges are dismissed up front and not leading to a deferred judgment, which involves an admission to a particular crime, they are entitled to petition for sealing of records, and in most instances that's granted. It's still discretionary under a weighing process. But here we have a person pursuant to a plea bargain, enters a plea, and then receives, as part of the plea bargain, a deferred judgment. In this particular case, I think it was for 2 years. It ended up continuing for 4 years. But at the end of that, it was dismissed. I mean, if we're just talking about cases being dismissed, why is this provision even around? It's around because conviction, as used in this particular context, also encompasses and includes deferred judgments, and certainly matters which were convictions at the time. The entry of the plea in this particular case, at the time the court accepted the deferred judgment agreement.
Well, does this person have to register?
They did have to register as part of that. At the conclusion of my understanding, look at the file, was that at the conclusion of that, sex offender registration statute allows them to petition the court to be discontinue registration under 1622-113.
And that happened here, did it not?
That's correct.
So he was delisted, if you will, from the registry.
That's correct.
Okay. And see, I find that a little bit troubling if we're talking about trying to construe this Title 16 provision as a whole, where you seem to be saying, well, the intent clearly must have been to sweep in this definition of conviction. And yet, within Title 16, there shows some legislative intent to at least allow someone who has successfully completed a deferred judgment to petition to be removed from the registry. So it counts for something. And I guess given that, I'm left struggling to conclude that necessarily we're supposed to include convictions as being barred from sealing.
These statutes are interrelated. They're not identical. Obviously, denial of a sealing, all that means is that the record indicates the arrest and, in most cases, only the outcome of the case. And, in fact, the dismissal of the case would probably be indicated on a NCIC, CCIC. In the other case, there's a more onerous duty for the sex offender registration in that the individual has to go to the local law enforcement agency and periodically register, and they're put on a special list, which citizens can obtain limited information about the individuals that might be in their or might be convicted sex offenders living in their area. That's a little bit different. It requires a different burden. And the legislature obviously saw fit to, in that instance, to allow them to apply at the conclusion of their deferred judgment. That's correct. It all comes back to this one problem, and I think Judge Connolly had it correct. Why is this, what is the meaning of this statute if not for situations such as this? If it's a conviction, clearly it's not sealable. If it's under a deferred, if the conviction existed at one time, then we have records concerning that. This particular statute and the court's interpretation precludes the sealing of those records.
Counsel, could I stop you right there on that question as well? What about a situation where someone is convicted at trial, but then that conviction is overturned on appeal? In that situation, you have a conviction that existed at one time. Would that person be barred from petitioning to seal his records based on the existence of, a conviction had existed at one point in the past, even though it's been wiped clean on appeal?
Well, presuming that that the case didn't go back to trial or that it went back to the court and was dismissed, I think in that instance, they would be eligible if it was a non-sex-related offense. I think there's clearly an intent in the statute to treat these particular offenses differently than other types of crimes.
Okay, so just so I make sure I understand your argument, you're saying that even someone who is convicted of a sex offense under the scenario I've just presented would not be able to have or petition to have their record sealed even if that conviction were overturned at some later point on appeal, if it was dismissed.
In that instance, let's put it this way. There was no plea entered. There was no conviction at all, or that conviction was overturned. I think in that's a different situation than what we're talking under 3C. We're talking about a situation where a conviction existed at some time and then obviously involving unlawful sexual behavior and then was and then may, as in this case, been dismissed. I'm not sure that I think in the instance of an acquittal or the overturning, maybe the statute has not directly addressed that, but it seems to be a different situation than when the person in a particular case has pled guilty, admitted to guilt. In that instance, they never did that.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Why didn't they include the definition of conviction under subsection 1622.102, subsection 3? If that's what their intent was, why didn't they reference that in the statute?
Your Honor, I have no idea other than to indicate that perhaps they felt that since we are linking up to this other statutory structure, that that's part and parcel of unlawful sexual behavior because the statute deals with all kinds of different convictions or definitions of convictions, an expanded definition of conviction that includes deferred judgments.
And counsel, I guess I have struggled to make that leap, because if you do trace the legislative history, that link was very direct under prior versions of the statute, and now it doesn't exist. And you seem to be asking us to rope it in because it was an oversight, if you will.
I think in that argument, I think mostly coincides with Judge Connolly's ruling in this case, and that we did have a conviction, and that conviction existed. The only reason it got dismissed is by agreement of the parties in a plea bargain. That particular, whether it's an oversight or whether the legislature felt that if we reference if we take this particular provision and refer over in the same statute, in the same session law, over to the Sex Offender Registration Act with its definitional section, that they should be, that the definition of conviction, which isn't otherwise defined in the sealing statute, would apply to this particular matter. If we're talking about the language that we're using under paragraph 9, that also encompasses or incorporates the language in paragraph 9.
You'll excuse me if I call this the plea bargaining machine, right? I mean, the prosecution agreed with this deal. It didn't have to. And there doesn't appear to me to be any disclosure that you can't get sealing if you enter into one of these. So that was my concern about why this hasn't been articulated before and what the assumptions are that defendants will go into this kind of arrangement and convict themselves, you know, for the purpose of, you know, contrary to the purpose of getting it dismissed and sealed and life goes on.
There are benefits, obviously, in any plea bargain, and part of them is obviously in a deferred to avoid prison, to avoid more serious penalties. At the same time, to get the individual enrolled in treatment and into programs dealing with this particular kind of offender. Also, the case, a person can legitimately indicate that his case was dismissed, because that did occur at the end of this. But the bottom line is, does that mean that the records have to be erased or removed from public view, where we have a particular individual that has had a history of, or at least an incident of a sex offense? I think there's a strong public interest involved in this, and I think if you talk in terms of policy, you look at the statute, and there's no other reason for it that exists, and I think the Court of Appeals got it right on that particular analysis.
Mr. Milne, could you just summarize specifically what your statutory, what you'd like this court to, how you'd like us to construe that statute? Not the philosophy, just the wording of it.
I believe that this court should interpret the term conviction to both under the definition of paragraph 3 under the Sex Offender Registration Act, which also encompasses and includes deferred judgments, and also because a conviction, as I think did exist in this case, because of the plea at the pursuant to the plea bargain, just as the Court of Appeals indicated. For that reason, I would ask the Court to affirm the Court of Appeals ruling, which overturned the sealing of records in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Turner, rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to respond to Justice Marcus's hypothetical. I think it hits the nail right on the head. To rule the way the Court of Appeals did would be to agree that at one point in time there was a conviction. The gentleman who goes to trial and is convicted and then acquitted on appeal finds himself with the same problem that MT finds himself with today. And that person wouldn't be able, under the Court of Appeals rationale, to get his record sealed. I think that's an inappropriate construction. It's bad policy, and it's not logical. It's not what the General Assembly would have intended. Therefore, I think you should rule in our favor, and that means that, to respond to Justice Bender's question, we believe that a deferred judgment is not part of a, quote, conviction, unquote, as used in subsection 3C of the sealing statute. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both parties for your arguments. The matter will be submitted on the briefs, and we'll take up our next case about 30, 40.